All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm your host, Ben Domenech. You can email us, as always, at radio@thefederalist.com. You can follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. I'm happy to be joined today by Shadi Hamid. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. You can follow him on Twitter at Shadi Hamid. He's also the author of multiple books, and you are probably familiar with his writings at The Atlantic and elsewhere, and perhaps with his podcast that he does, The Wisdom of Crowds, which you should subscribe to if you want to hear some very intelligent people navigating this ridiculous time we inhabit. Shadi, great to have you with me. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this moment that we are in. But first, I want to circle back to a lengthy Twitter thread that you had a while back about shifting expectations and shifting viewpoints that you had related to populism within this particular moment. I know that we are always trying to be forward-looking in difficult times, and we have to navigate this with a little bit of humility, because we don't necessarily know how things are going to turn out. What are some of the takeaways that you've had from this particular moment, especially as it relates to the political success of populism around the world?
Yeah, so I think in that thread, what I was talking about was basically that I was partly wrong. At the start of COVID, the COVID era, which seems like forever ago, I guess this was in mid to late March, I wrote a piece in The Atlantic where I sort of was fantasizing about a return to normalcy, and I was longing for technocratic, competent leadership. And I'm someone who generally is pretty anti-technocratic and suspicious of people who make these claims that as long as you put the brilliant, correct experts in power, all else will go well. So to sort of see myself wanting more of that was interesting to me, and I tried to be honest about it. So I wrote a piece partly on that, and I thought that maybe that would lead to undermining right-wing populist parties in various parts of the world. But then in this thread, which was more recent, I guess just a couple of weeks ago, I was revising that, because what I've seen in the COVID period is that you can't really trust experts all that much, as if we had to be reminded of that. We were, that, we have the best and the brightest. We have the great, medical professionals, epidemiologists, so on and so forth, but they got quite a few things wrong. And that led to a lot of, to what I saw as growing distrust towards elites. So for example, at the beginning, it was like, you don't have to wear masks if you're healthy. But then it changed 180 degrees just a month or two later. And then there were changes on outdoor transmission. And all of a sudden, people realized that the risk of transmission is extremely low. And this was after people were criticizing Floridians for basically self-killing, that because they were going back to the beaches early on, that look at those crazy, I don't know if Florida's in the South technically, but those Floridians, those Southerners, look at them, these people from
Ritz. Florida is Florida.
Yeah, exactly. But this idea that, oh my God, the red state people who aren't listening to experts, they're doing their own thing, and look at the destruction that will result. And that didn't really turn out to be the case. I mean, it's not perfect, but still, it wasn't this worst case scenario. So, and then we see other examples like Japan, where they didn't do a full lockdown and they still had relatively good results. And then people had trouble explaining that. And I just feel like there was a lot of confusion. And I think what all of this leads to, and this was before the recent protests after the killing of George Floyd. And I think what I've seen just the past couple of weeks with public health officials, I made this joke on Twitter, I don't know if people really got it. Some people did, where I was like, public health officials have really risen to the occasion during this time of crisis. And I was being sarcastic, obviously, because they further undermined their position by basically putting politics ahead of everything else. I mean, I think that people can make the argument that a protest for something you believe strongly in, against police abuse and brutality, that's worth protesting for, but at least be honest and straight up that, well, there might be some increased risk of transmission of the disease. Don't just write it off and say that police brutality is a bigger health threat than COVID. I mean, that's not true technically. Yeah. I mean, that's just not accurate.
Yeah.
So, you know,
if police brutality killed 117,000 Americans a year, it would be beyond the biggest like crisis that we face. I mean, that just is factually just not true.
Yeah. So at some level, you see this over and over again. And then the broader context of this is experts and commentators and mostly center left pundits, but also maybe some center right ones getting Russiagate wrong. And I was a big critic of the maximalist accusations of collusion on that. And then the whole discourse around American democracy is about to die. We're literally on the brink of becoming a dictatorship almost 4 years into the Trump era. That hasn't turned out to be true. So if people who are supposedly the best and the brightest keep on getting pretty big things wrong time and time again, at some point you just got to be like, what's going on here?
Yeah. One of the things that I think is really frustrating about this to me is that as someone who shares your skepticism about the power of the expert technocrat class, regardless of what results you want to achieve, it really frustrates me how unwilling they are to question themselves. You know, when what I've heard over the years is always that, you know, well, the thing about the experts is that they really study, they want to get things right, and then they do after action reports and autopsies, and they figure out what they got wrong, and they adjust. And I actually think that what we've seen in the last couple of decades is the reverse of that, that they're very unwilling to turn the light onto themselves, ask the hard questions, and reevaluate what they ought to do in the future. Now, this may seem a little broad, but you know, one of the big examples of that, of course, is the Republican Party and under both Mitt Romney and the things that came later in their analysis, where it really seemed like a lot of wishful thinking about the constituency they'd like to have as opposed to the one that they do have. And that's something that ended up being exploited by the guy who's currently the president of the United States. And it's frustrating to me because on a certain level, I know we always need to have experts. We always need to have elites that occupy these positions, but we ought to hope for a better class of them. And I have this slogan, and we put it on stickers for the Federalists: consider the possibility we are led by idiots. And what I want to sort of say is we're going to be led one way or another. We're not going to sweep away the concept of having, you know, experts at the CDC or the FDA or the like, but we need them to be a higher quality. Like we need to have confidence in them. We need to know that when they come out and they say you should wear masks or you shouldn't wear masks, that like that, there's something behind that that we can have faith in and trust. And unfortunately, that's just not the case right now. And I don't know how to get that better class of elite, better class of expert back. Do you have any ideas?
I mean, I totally agree. We do need experts. We do need technocratic elites because some things require higher levels of education, especially in science and medicine and so on. But what I think we need more of is humility, that even people who reach these high levels of expertise, there has to be something that keeps them in check in case they go too far or in case they're not willing to interrogate their own starting premises. And, you know, what a lot of this comes down to is even people who are well-meaning, who know their stuff really well, we all come at what we do from a different set of starting assumptions. And oftentimes we don't state those outright. So I have a particular set of views about human nature and what motivates humans to do certain things, about the role of religion in public life. And that guides everything that I write because they're pretty foundational. Mm-hmm. But if you don't share my starting premises and you're still a smart, well-meaning person, you might come to a very different set of conclusions. So I think one thing, we have to be more clear about what our starting assumptions are. And that I think is the key of healthy debate. But we also have to allow for self-criticism. And if it's not coming from within ourselves as individuals, because that's a lot to ask. And it's a lot to ask from very smart people, because one thing I've realized is that it's the smartest people who are most unwilling to question how they got things wrong or to kind of go back in the past and be honest about that. I mean, I wish it was otherwise, but you spend, I mean, I think that a lot of the people I spend time with are pretty smart. Some of them are not willing to engage in self-criticism. So that's where I think, you know, you have bureaucracies, you have technocratic elites, but that's where elected officials, and you hope that elected officials are good in some way. Unfortunately, they're often not these days in our politics, but there's a kind of check and balance where you have on one hand bureaucrats and on the other hand elected officials, and then you have the media, which you hope plays a positive checking role. And I'm losing faith in that as well, and that's a whole, you know, different story obviously. But yeah, our key institutions in that regard that are all supposed to play a particular role in producing better outcomes, they all seem to be failing, but in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you bring up the media, and I'd love to talk to you a little bit about that, because one of the biggest things that I think the media got wrong, and I think we agree on this point, is their entire narrative that that began with Trump's election was fueled by the release of the Steele dossier and you know, continued throughout the media's coverage, particularly cable news, over the next following couple of years, really had a lot of Americans convinced that Bob Mueller, when he looked into this, would find, you know, metric tons of evidence of collusion on the part of the Trump campaign. And you know, whatever you think they found, they didn't find that. And they certainly didn't find something that, you know, could prove beyond any kind of level of reasonable doubt of any kind of action that was really up to scale with what was being promised to a lot of people by America's politicians. And to me, I really am surprised, and maybe this is just my own naivete, that there hasn't been more of a push on the part of responsible actors within the media to look back at that. Eric Wemple at the Washington Post has done some of it. There have been a couple of other people who've done it. But basically to say, why did we get this story wrong? Why did so many smart people get this story wrong? Why did we put so much faith in people who had just left the intelligence community or other, you know, significant government roles about things that, you know, when they, it turns out when they were under oath, they were saying, I didn't actually see anything that looked like that. I just was saying that or saying something that implied that on TV. I would think this would be a moment where people would be saying, we should look at this the way that we looked at why we thought, you know, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. It's that level of kind of botch. Why do you think it is that there's just an unwillingness to do that? Because if you do look at it and you are responsible about it, then people can have more faith in you afterwards. It's if you ignore it that people say, well, I can't trust them. They told me for a couple of years that Trump was a goner.
Yeah, so I mean, one part of it is that has to do with Trump. Trump, I think, has really, you know, and speaking as someone who's on the left side of the political spectrum, I think that for a lot of like my tribe, the obsession with Trump has distorted analysis and understanding of the world. If you see everything through the lens of Trump's badness, and I very much do agree, Trump, I wish to God that Trump hadn't become president, and I hope he doesn't continue being president. That said, he isn't the explanation of all bad things in the world.
Oh no, and that's, no, stop. You're not allowed to say that. You'll get in trouble, Shadi.
Yeah, no, it's funny you mentioned that. I might actually, I mean, that I guess in some quarters is a controversial statement. So I think that's part of it. And I put some of the, and this is one of the reasons that I'm angry at Trump, is he changed us. And obviously it's not entirely his fault, because we as individuals have to take responsibility for how we respond to Trump. And we allowed ourselves, many of us, to be manipulated by Trump. And we took the bait. He wanted to polarize the country, and we fell into the trap, and it distracted us from key issues. And I actually think that this has been a divide even on the left itself internally, where you have more centrist types who were really obsessed with Russiagate because they needed to process how, a big chunk of the country, tens of millions of Americans, could have voted for this person that they consider to be irredeemably bad and evil and racist and all of that. So they, I think that one thing Russiagate was, it was a way to say, well, there was an external actor, this other scapegoat, and that helps us explain how this unusual outcome came to be. And to the credit of quite a few folks on the left, including people like Bernie Sanders, they were willing to look more at the deeper structural issues that led to Trump in the first place. So I've always seen Trump as more the symptom of a deeper set of issues than the cause. And that's why, you know, even the premise behind Biden's campaign, which is once we get rid of Trump, we can get back to normal and be a normal country again and be more unified or whatever. We might get a little bit more, I mean, I hope, in the best case scenario, but at the end of the day, if we're not addressing why enough Americans decided to vote for a right-wing populist, and this is throughout the world too, because right-wing populists are winning in a wide variety of contexts, India, Israel, Philippines, Italy, Poland. I mean, these are pretty, Brazil. So something universal across the globe is happening. And at the very least, elites should be able to say, hey, something is happening here. Trump is part of a bigger story, but he is not the story himself.
Yeah, so I will put it slightly differently than you did. And it's something that I've said before, but I haven't brought it up in a while, which is that there's some people who see Trump as the disease. Some people see him as the symptom of the disease. For his supporters, and for the supporters of a lot of these right-wing populists around the world, I would argue that they see these candidates as basically a potential cure, and maybe a desperate cure. Like, you know, when you've exhausted other efforts and you're just trying desperately to get something that will cure whatever ails you. And that's how they perceive these candidates. There was a comment made by Fiona Hill to The Guardian this week where she was criticizing populism. And she said, populists are notoriously ill-fitted to govern. I'm going to get the quote wrong, but basically they're not good at governing. They don't listen to expert class, and that's the real problem with them. And I just wanted to, I mean, if I could, I would ask Fiona Hill, like, why do you think that they're so successful? Shouldn't the elite class be looking to, as a matter of leadership, borrow certain elements from these successful populists in order to get that job in the first place? I mean, it's easy to forget, but probably the most elite president that we've had out of the last, in our lifetime, certainly here in America, has got to be George H.W. Bush. But in 1988, he ran as a populist. You know, his "Read My Lips, No New Taxes" is like that's such a populist line. You know, he ran as being kind of a guy who was this follower on to Reagan in a way that, you know, was, yes, a little disingenuous, but was also a way to get someone who is, by any standard, an elite who is, you know, has been building his career in order to get this job. You got to get the job first in order to be able to lead.
I mean, it's interesting. I hadn't actually thought of George H.W. Bush as a populist, but you're right. That line. Okay.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. Do you need to go get it?
Let me just, one second.
Yeah, hang on. I'll pause. Okay, go ahead.
So I'll just start with that answer again. So that's really interesting. I hadn't really thought of George H.W. Bush as a populist, but you're right. I mean, read your lips. That kind of captures it. But, you know, I agree with Fiona that that populists aren't great at governing, at least so far, once they're actually in power. But I think what we have to learn from them is what they do before they come to power, because clearly they're able to tap into something quite real. And when you look at right-wing populists, but also left-wing populists, what they all share, and this is part of the definition of the word, is they know how to find adversaries, even enemies, let's say. They differ on who the bad other is. I mean, right-wing populists, unfortunately, sometimes get into the realm of xenophobia. Certainly in Europe, we see anti-Muslim sentiment of various sorts, and immigrants more generally. And then left-wing populists, they see corporations and establishment elites as perpetuating inequality. But what they all get at is that we as human beings, we want, if things aren't going well and we're like online and we're, and especially the more well-educated you are, the more you tend to be ideological because you're very engaged on the issues of the day and you have stronger opinions and so on. So what that leads to is this, like, there's a thrill of having an enemy politically. So we're always looking for someone to define ourselves against. And even now I'm finding myself in a bit of this position that I'm angry at a certain set of folks online and on Twitter right now. And I'm trying to be self-conscious about not being pushed in a particular direction just because they're annoying me. So for example, like all the woke stuff that's going on, it really, really not just annoys me, but frightens me at a pretty deep level.
Tell me why. Tell me why does it frighten you?
I mean, one is that it just basically intolerant of a rich, diverse public debate. There are certain ideas that are considered beyond the pale. And of course, some ideas should be beyond the pale. Like, I don't think that anyone who thinks slavery was good should have a place in public debate. But there are a lot of things that are unsettled that we still haven't resolved as a country. So if 40% of the country think something and they support Trump and they have a set of quote unquote bad views on whatever set of issues, I think that we can disagree with them and we can think those ideas are bad, but we shouldn't think the people who have those ideas are bad. And I think we've lost sight of that distinction. Now, if someone has a bad idea, it says something about they themselves are morally abhorrent. There's something wrong with them in terms of their very constitution. That you can't live in a healthy democracy if you think the other half of the country is beyond redemption. And the woke stuff isn't even saying that just the Trump supporters are beyond redemption. They're saying that even people who would otherwise be their allies, if they don't toe the line on saying the right things, like, so if you get very critical about looting, or say that, hey, violent riots are bad, which as of 3 years ago was a standard innocuous position that all reasonable people basically agreed on. Now the Overton window is shifting. And, you know, as we've seen, there was this data analyst, David Shore, who appears to have been either fired or censured or something like that, because he spoke about rioting as potentially having negative effects on the development of cities, which I think is an important point that seems to be empirically true. But then he's considered to be persona non grata in certain circles. So that's scary because it narrows debate even among your fellow travelers. And also, I think another part of this is the religious impulses behind the woke religion, if you will.
Yes.
I'm someone who thinks that religion is important for public life. It gives it offers important things for individuals, but also for having a common language that, you know, there several decades ago or many decades ago, there was a common Christian culture. It wasn't always great, but at least there was a sense that Christianity wasn't evil and that even if you weren't practicing, people could acknowledge that there were some positive things that they could draw on from that Christian tradition, right?
Yeah.
Now we've become much more, you know, if you're a Christian and you're vaguely traditionalist or conservative, chances are you'll be in the Republican Party. If you're a hardcore secularist, chances are you'll be in the Democratic Party. So now we have a really profound divide. But what we might have hoped for is that as Democrats and liberals move away from Christianity, that they might become more reasonable and rational and tolerant, but that hasn't turned out to be the case because I'm a believer that at some basic level, human beings need to believe in something ultimate. There has to be an ultimate loyalty. It doesn't have to be God, but if it's not God, it's gonna be a cause, it's gonna be a movement, it's gonna be some dogma or some orthodoxy. But the problem is sometimes that replacement orthodoxy is either not that good on its own, or is worse than the Christianity that it's replacing. At least with Christianity, you have a tradition and you have rules and regulations and you have clerics who can say, hey, you're going too far. Obviously, some people still go very far, and we've seen how that can be pretty bad, but at least there's a framework that has been developed over centuries, right? The problem with the woke orthodoxy is that it's a new religion, to use that analogy, and the clerics who are deciding what's appropriate and what's not are pretty radical and pretty aggressive, and they still don't fully agree on where the red lines are themselves. And it's always becoming, how do you become more progressive than the other person? And it's this never ending outbidding. So that worries me, that if you're going to do religion, do religion. Mm-hmm. If you're not going to do religion, do something that doesn't try to mimic the certainty and conviction of religion. Because in this sense, it's religion, but with a false god, let's say.
It's religion with indulgences, with sacrifices, with self-flagellation, and without any real grace.
Yes, without grace, yes.
There's a couple of things I wanted to ask you about how this current moment relates to something that I know you spent a lot of time writing about and paying attention to, which is the Arab Spring. There are different phenomenons obviously going on here. The differences in the countries involved that, you know, are significant. But as you reflect on it, do you view the George Floyd police brutality moment as being something that is at least in the same neighborhood as some of the sparks that set off the Arab Spring?
I guess a short answer would be no, only insofar as the U.S. is not a dictatorship. And one thing I was uncomfortable
with...
Wait
a minute. Can you say that? No, go ahead.
I'm someone who, like, I think the protests are really important for getting concessions on reforming police, criminal justice reform. Those are things that I think we need to do. And in that sense, I see the protests in their broad form as being positive, but then I see the excesses that have come along with it, which to me don't have to be part of it. And but you know, when it comes to the comparisons with the Arab Spring, I think that I saw a lot of those comparisons when the protests started, that we're having our own Arab Spring, and people trying to draw these rather broad analogies, which I thought were really stretching things, but also it bothered me because I felt like people who didn't know much about the Middle East were using the Middle East as a prop.
Yes.
Or using Arab protesters as an instrument to make a point that has nothing to do with caring about Arabs or about Syrians or the 500,000 who were dead, who, let's be honest, a lot of folks on the left did not feel compelled to speak out against that. Some of them even were on the asset side of the spectrum. And I think we had even talked about this in a previous podcast a couple of years back. So I didn't like this idea that you use something not because you care about what you're using, but because you think it's helpful for your own narrative. So that was one thing. But also, when you're protesting against a dictatorship, that's different than protesting in a democratic context. And this also relates to how we view violence and looting. Because if you think that America is a dictatorship, if you think it's an irredeemable white supremacist state that is like evil and is consumed by original sin and has nothing good about it, then the logical conclusion there is that violence may be necessary. And this is why you hear some of this language, by any means necessary. The only reason anyone should use that language is if you're operating in a dictatorial context. And even then, violence is not something you should be doing. Peaceful protest, we know empirically, is more effective. And violent protests, as we saw in violent rebellion, even in the case of Syria, that ultimately did not work out very well for the Syrian people, so on and so forth. So So anything that brings us closer to saying that violence can be legitimized when we have peaceful options, because look, America is flawed. Yes, we don't, there are problems in our democracy. And you know, people don't have the voice they probably should, especially in more disadvantaged parts of the country and so on and so forth. At the same time, there are ways to organize. There are ways to protest peacefully. There are ways to vote. And this is where I thought it was very important for folks in, you know, in various places where protests were happening, like Killer Mike in Atlanta or the mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Bottoms. And they were saying, listen, violence is not going to get us what we want. What will get us what we want is voting for people who share our positions on police reform, ending mass incarceration, criminal justice reform more broadly. That's the way you get change done. And that's what makes us different than the Arab world, is because in countries like Egypt or Saudi Arabia or whatever, you are not allowed to protest peacefully or any kind of protest. We are allowed to do that here. And there is something inspiring about, and I thought those images were inspiring when I saw, you know, as many as hundreds of thousands of Americans in the past few weeks. And after it became more broad-based and the violent parts of it went down, it was primarily a big tent protest movement where it was almost like a festive atmosphere here in D.C. That's the way you do it in this country. That's what brings people to your side.
I also believe that the most violent elements of it, with a few exceptions, the looting, the violence that was coming out of that, I think that that was exacerbated by the lockdown, and that there were a lot of people who were just kind of riding along with a public social movement where they thought they could get away with some stuff by saying, oh yeah, no, I'm doing it because of this. And it's like, no, you just are blowing off some steam. And I was worried, frankly, that something like that would happen all along as these lockdowns continued. I do want to ask you, as we kind of wrap up, about your perspective on the iconoclasm that's going on right now, people taking down statues, talking about different things that need to come down. It actually surprises me that there's not more support for taking down Confederate statues. The polling consistently only shows about a third of Americans supporting taking those down. You know, personally, I've been very much of the category of saying, you shouldn't knock them down as a mob. You should come together as a representative, Democratic Republic, and make these decisions yourselves as a community, where you want things to be, and whether you think something should go into a museum or a graveyard instead of being at the center of your life. But that conversation has quickly shifted in just the ways that a lot of history defenders have argued toward, you know, statues of Thomas Jefferson and the like. You know, we've seen the conversation about statues of Churchill, you know, for instance. What's your perspective on the proper response to that level of iconoclasm among a generation of people in the West who, let's face it, haven't learned a lot about their history, don't even necessarily know who some of these people are? They just see a statue and they say, oh, that's going to come down, and that person's probably a racist because they were born, you know, more than 40 years ago.
You know, I think the biggest issue that I have with the whole new, like, statue taking down movement, or whatever we want to call it, is that it's replacing a substantive politics of change with a performative politics of symbolism. It's easy for people, especially, you know, upper class white liberals, to get behind something which is just easy because it's visual. There's statues, obviously these are Confederate folks, so they're bad, you know. So it's an easy narrative for people to latch onto. It doesn't take any kind of self-sacrifice. It doesn't take an actual checking of privilege, this term that we hear all the time, which I think has been misused, because if you really want to check your privilege, then you address structural inequality and you think about how, like, do all these upper class white liberals who are now, like, becoming woke church folk or whatever, are they really willing to sacrifice their standard of living to help people of color if push comes to shove? You know, I'm skeptical, right? So I think that in that way, in that sense, the statues are a distraction. But a lot of our politics now, I think, has become play acting and performance. Even what you see on Twitter a lot of the time it's this kind of endless virtue signaling. And to be fair, I mean, I think it happens all across the political spectrum. It's not just the woke folks. I think both the right and the left have been doing this in a way for quite a while. And the problem is they react against each other. And so one side is doing performative politics. The other side does the reaction to that. So, you know, the whole thing about how folks on the right do something they otherwise wouldn't do because they want to own the libs. It can be vaguely amusing sometimes if you're aware of what you're doing, but it's also, politics should not be about owning the other side. Politics should be about actually having ideological goals and pursuing them in good faith. So I just worry that the statues bring us back to a very, it's a politics of smallness. And if you're going to do the statues, and I agree with you, it should probably not be done through breaking things down and individuals like smashing things as like vigilante superheroes or whatever. It should be done through a process of deliberation on the local level. Because again, we live in a democracy. The way we make decisions in a democracy and the way we have accountability and the way that we build consensus, if folks in a local area come to that conclusion to take a statue down, great, but that's the way it should be done. And it's interesting too that people are forgetting, we don't hear as much language about class and structural inequality now, and I don't think that's a coincidence. And you know, one thing I liked about Bernie is that I think he understood that if you want to help people of color, but also who are disproportionately affected by cycles of poverty in the inner city, you have to address structural inequality, but in a way that isn't just about race. Yeah. You have to bring class and economic inequality more broadly into it. And that's how you build broader coalitions for change on this. And it's just interesting to me that we've stopped focusing on that. And now we're talking about Robin DiAngelo's book, and she's, you know, apparently this corporate consultant and number one Amazon bestseller, where it's about individual bias. And I worry about that because, let's be honest, we're not going to change structural issues like on housing policy and criminal justice reform just by a bunch of white folks reading a book and saying, oh, I'm atoning for sin, the original sin of my, you know, that's not how you do systemic change.
You can follow Shadi Hamid on Twitter at Shadi Hamid. Thanks so much for taking the time to join me today, Shadi, to talk about this.
Yeah, my pleasure, Ben. Thanks for having me.
I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. You need